Hey, you guys, welcome back to Flickers of Fear. The movie that we're talking about today is kind of like a random pick. This is so weird. All right, so we're talking about this movie, which I kind of feel like is a really forgotten thriller from 1987, and it's called Dead of Winter. Now, when I was doing a search on YouTube for other reviews of this, just to kind of get an idea of how other people felt about it, I found one, count them, one other review of this movie, and it was like 3 minutes long, had 66 views, and the girl really didn't like it. So, I mean, I kind of feel like that might be unprecedented. It's like these movies that I didn't realize that this movie was that obscure, but you learn something new every day, I guess. But yeah, so one other review, I don't think I've ever had that happen. Now, the reason that I picked this one is because this is one of those ones that I feel like was on cable a shit ton, like in the late 80s and early 90s. So I feel like this was one that I watched a whole bunch of times, but then I didn't see it again subsequently. But obviously, the cover of it, the name of it made enough of an impression that when I was scrolling through Amazon Prime a couple of weeks ago, I noticed that it was free, like for with the subscription, and I was kind of like, oh, I should put that on the list and like actually go and watch that. Unfortunately, by the time I got around to watching it, they didn't have the free one anymore, so I actually just had to pay $3.99 to rent it, which, like I said, is no big deal because I'd already kind of like put it on the schedule and plan to do it. So it's kind of one of those movies that I was really interested to revisit it because it's just one that I remember seeing a lot on cable, but all I remembered from it was that Mary Steenburgen was in it because I love her. Actually, I think I watched everything with her in it in the 80s just because I liked her so much in Time After Time from 1979. And also Roddy McDowall is in it, and I love him, obviously, because he's in everything awesome, but it's like particularly mid to late 80s. He was in Fright Night, obviously, so I was just kind of like watching everything with him in it too. So since both of them were in it, I was kind of like, yeah, this is going to be right in my wheelhouse. And I love thrillers, I love all that kind of like creepy, and it has a kind of a little bit of a gothic, old-fashioned kind of vibe. So it would have been like right up my alley. I didn't really remember much about it other than Mary Steenburgen going to this creepy old house and a dude in a wheelchair and her like getting in some kind of trouble. I didn't remember anything about what the plot was or, it's kind of like your standard thriller plot, but I didn't really remember like what all the specifics were. Probably because on rewatching this, I'm like, this plot is super complicated. And I'm actually not really even sure I understand entirely what happened, but I don't know. We'll get into this. So this was directed by Arthur Penn, who was the same guy, like in the 60s and 70s, he did a lot of movies. He did Bonnie and Clyde, Alice's Restaurant, he did stuff like that. And then later on, he kind of went more into like TV and stage type stuff. I think he was like an executive producer on Law and Order for a while. Oh, he also directed Penn and Teller Get Killed. So there was that. This movie, which I didn't know at the time, was actually kind of a remake, although the movie that it was, supposedly loosely remaking was called My Name is Julia Ross, and that came out in 1945. And that movie was actually, in turn, based on a 1941 novel called The Woman in Red by Anthony Gilbert. Now, I haven't seen the 1945 one, but I read the synopsis. And even though in its bare bones, like kind of fiction, like setup, like narrative setup, it is similar to this one, but this one is like a lot different. The original one is actually set in England, and it's about a woman who goes to be like a live-in housekeeper or something like that, or a live-in secretary for this like sick widow. And she ends up like becoming a prisoner there, and then all the people there are like gaslighting her into thinking she's somebody else. And like when she protests this, they just say, oh, she's having a nervous breakdown and she doesn't know what she's talking about. So it's like a very gaslighty situation, which, like I said, I guess there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on in thrillers. So, like I said, the bare setup of Dead of Winter is similar. Although some of the stuff like motivations and stuff are different, but as far as I could determine, the original movie didn't have this really complicated blackmail plot, which is kind of what happens in this one. So what happens in this? Mary Steenburgen. Oh, and I was gonna say too, just as kind of like evidence of how maybe forgotten this movie is. is that this actually did come out on Blu-ray for a little while, I think, like VHS and DVD and maybe Blu-ray later on. But it didn't really have hardly any extras on it. And I think it even then like went out of print. So I kind of feel like this is one that sort of slipped through the cracks. And actually there were kind of like a lot of whodunits, like good ones that came out in the 80s, you know, like Death Trap and Sleuth and stuff like that. This is kind of along those lines, you know, because I don't know, thrillers are just such an evergreen genre and they make so many of them. And I guess the plots of them are sort of similar, interchangeable. But I mean, that's, you know, that's not to say like a lot of horror movie plots are interchangeable too. It's just like, if that's your jam, if that's what you like, then that's not going to bother you. But I do kind of feel like if one wasn't really, really spectacular, like standout, then they made so many of them like during this time period that a lot of them got forgotten. And this is one of them. And honestly, I kind of like, there's a lot to like about this movie. Like I said, the setup, like the mystery, the plot and everything like that, when it's resolved, it's kind of like complicated and I'm not sure that it's entirely believable. You know, a lot of the stuff I'm not sure is entirely believable. And even like reviews at the time were kind of like, yeah, shit wouldn't like go down like this, or why doesn't she just do that, or why doesn't she just do this, or whatever. So I can kind of see that. But I will say that one of the best things about this, they shot it in Toronto, was this real kind of creepy, I mean, it's very, very, like, the weather is just, like, this big, like, fucking snowstorms and blizzards. So, like, everything's very bleak and white, and there's, like, the dead trees. And the house that they shot it in is, like, really isolated, and the inside of it is, like, super, super creepy and gothic and all this other kind of stuff. Like, it's kind of like a hunting lodge type situation. For a long time, like I said, you know that something nefarious is going on with the situation, but you're not sure entirely what it is. So, it's that kind of thing. So, this, like I said, if you're into thrillers, particularly ones from this era, like from the 80s, and you haven't seen this one, then I would recommend it. It's not the best one I've ever seen. And like I said, it's a little convoluted. And, you know, there are some points in it where probably, you know, the protagonist could have like done something else, like to get herself out of that situation, and it doesn't work out. But it's a totally like passable, you know, decent one. And I kind of think it's sad that it sort of got forgotten about, especially because it's kind of had a lot of like a real big talent behind it. Like I said, I always really liked Mary Steenburgen and Roddy McDowall, of course, always delightful to watch. So what we have at the very beginning, you have this kind of like prologue sort of scene. And it's supposedly New Year's Eve. It's really, really snowy. There's this woman whose face you don't see. She's kind of wearing like a hat and like a, you know, a trench coat or whatever. And she goes in this train station, and there's like this complex that, well, not complex, but it's like two different lockers with this one has a key for another one and blah, blah, blah. So she goes and gets this bag that's full of money. And she drives her car to like the middle of this parking lot in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, so obviously you pretty much know from context clues, okay, well, she's there to like drop off something to like a blackmailer or, you know, a ransom or something like that. So she gets out, she goes in a phone booth, and then she's like calling the person. She's like, look, the dude's not here. If he doesn't come in 5 minutes, I'm just fucking leaving. Cause you know, even if you're being blackmailed or kidnapped or whatever, it's just kind of like, look, I got shit to do. All right. I'm not waiting around. But yeah, so she gets back in the car and then she gets killed. Like a guy's in the back seat and he strangles her. And then he cuts off her ring finger, like on her left hand. So that's like your prologue. Then you jump ahead to New York City. And you have this woman named Katie McGovern, who's played by Mary Steenburgen. And she is working as a waitress, but she's also an actress. And like she says later on that she'd been in some soap operas, she'd been in some commercials and stuff like that. But she's, you know, doing waitressing like in between gigs, as a lot of actors do. So she's living in an apartment with her, I thought initially it was her boyfriend, but I guess later he calls her his wife. So I guess that's her husband. And his name is Rob, I think. Now, he's a photographer, but he has been in some kind of accident or whatever, and his leg is broken, so he can't really get around all that much. So I guess, like, they live in this tiny apartment, and, like, Mary Steenburgen's brother, I keep calling her by her actor name, Katie's brother, has been staying there with them, like, presumably to help take care of Rob, like, while Katie's out working or whatever. So I guess they're having, like, all kinds of money problems. They make, like, a thing about, Katie's like, well, I really have to, you know, get back to getting some acting gigs because, like, you know, our bills are behind, the rent's behind, you know, a bunch of shit in the apartment is broken. It's kind of like your standard, holy shit, we're broke, we really need a job kind of thing. Now, she actually sees an ad in Variety or whatever have you, and it sounds like kind of a good gig. Now, it's very vague, like the wording of it. Basically, the ad says, we need a woman who is going to be a leading actress to replace, you know, a leading actress that left. Somebody needs to travel. We need you right away. You know, really good pay, shit like that. So Katie goes to this audition. There's a whole bunch of other women there. And she walks in, and Roddy McDowall is acting as, presumably, the casting director. And he looks up at her, and he's immediately struck. And he's, like, having her, like, turn, you know, her head and all this other kind of stuff. Hey, can you put your hair up and stuff? And basically, he's like, okay, you know, you're the one. So he doesn't even really interview her. She doesn't, like, have to audition, really, or anything. So he's like, basically, here's the situation. We were making this movie, and we had this lead actress named Julie Rose who had a nervous breakdown. Like, she walked off the set and had a nervous breakdown, and she doesn't want to fucking do it anymore. And they want to reuse, it's like they're working on the movie right now, but they're kind of shooting around her, shooting scenes that don't have her in it. But they're eventually going to need to shoot more stuff with her in it. But we already shot a bunch of stuff with her, so we need an actress that looks pretty much exactly like her so we can just kind of, like, you know, keep going with the movie without trashing all the footage of her we already shot. So he's like, so we need somebody immediately. We're going up to this house in upstate New York, and you'll do, like, a video screen test to make sure, like, with the producers that you look enough like the woman and that you can, like, learn to do her voice and her mannerisms and stuff. And, you know, and then we'll go from there. And then, you know, he's going to love you. It's going to be cool. So, and, you know, they offer, like, a generous amount of money. I think it's, like, $3,000 just for the video taping, which, like I said, that's pretty decent money for 87. And then, like, another $9,000 for finishing out the movie. So, of course, she needs the money. She seems a little weirded out, but not that weirded out. And you know what I mean? Because it's, like, a lot of money. She needs it. So she's kind of like, okay, well, I have to go upstate New York for a few days. Her boyfriend, husband, whoever, is kind of, like, pissed off about it because he's like, well, you know, where are you going to be? But she leaves a number. It seems all very on the up and up. So Roddy McDowall's character, whose name is Mr. Murray, he drives her upstate New York. And, like, in this raging snowstorm. So they go, like I said, up to this really remote mansion, at which point she meets this guy named Dr. Lewis, whose house this presumably is. Now, he is a paraplegic, and I guess he's a retired psychiatrist, and you find out later that Mr. Murray, Roddy McDowall's character, used to be a patient of his. So again, that's, like, a little bit, you find that out a little bit later on. Obviously, Dr. Lewis was kind of like a big hunter type person because there's, like, all these big, like, stuffed polar bears and shit like that. And there's also, like, Chekhov's bear trap up in the attic. So, you know, you know that'll come into play, like, later on. Initially, like I said, so they explained to her the situation that this, you know, poor actress, you know, she took off and they really need somebody that looks exactly like her. So when she was like, wow, you really do look exactly like her. But they do have to, like, cut her hair because her hair is very, like, big 80s curly at the beginning. And I guess Julie Rose, the actress, had kind of like a short straight bob. So they're like, so they cut her hair, they dye it, like, more in line with the color. They give her pictures and show her, like, parts of, you know, or show her what she looks like. So you can kind of, like, you know, make yourself look like that. You know, but that's kind of the story they give. So they set up this video thing. They're like, so they have the video camera. You can tell that obviously this is probably not a movie type situation because they're a little, even though they have, like, all the, you know, the white umbrellas and the lights and everything, and it looks sort of professional, but the way they're going about stuff is not super professional. Like, the guy doesn't really say action. You know, Roddy McDowell's kind of, like, tripping over the light thing. So it's kind of like a little bit of a ramshackle kind of thing. But she apparently does okay on the screen test. So they make this videotape, you know, just to see what she looks like on camera, like, to make sure she looks enough like the other actress, supposedly. Like I said, you know from the jump that this is not really what's going on, because this is a thriller, so you know it's going to be some nefarious, like some diabolical kind of shit going on. So yeah, but she is, I mean, to her credit, she is kind of like initially suspicious, just kind of like, this just seems really weird. It's like nobody else is here, like other than you two guys, like at this big isolated house. And they're basically like, yeah, well, we're just making this videotape, and then we're going to take it to the producer's house, or, you know, or whatever, and, you know, and we'll see how it goes from there. So she's like, okay, whatever. And like I said, initially, both the guys seem super nice and super welcoming. It's, you know, Roddy McDowell, like, brings her some warm milk, like, before she goes to bed and everything like that. It's like, he's nice, but he's, like, overly nice a little bit. So you're just kind of, like, getting a little bit creeped out. Roddy McDowell is good in this, by the way. Because he's, like, super friendly, but also, like, really sinister, like, even from the beginning. So, yeah, so as it goes on, like, little things, she's like, oh, I told my husband that as soon as I got here, I would call him. And they're like, oh, of course you can. There's a phone in the kitchen. So she goes in there and, like, tries to make a phone call, but then there's no dial tone. And then, you know, they have an excuse for that, though. They're just like, oh, well, there's a really bad storm out. It's like a blizzard, which there was. And the lines go down sometimes, but, you know, it's all good. If the lines aren't back up tomorrow, you know, I'll have Mr. Murray, like, drive you into town and you can use a phone there. You know, don't worry about it. So, like I said, even though there's, like, little things like that that are kind of like, oh, this is kind of weird, nothing that's too alarming. However, very shortly into her stay, a couple things happen. One thing is that the videotape that she makes, Roddy McDowell, who he's gonna, like, take her to use a phone the next day, but of course the car won't start. Because he's like, oh, you know, the engine must be frozen up or anything like that. So, like I said, there is a blizzard outside, so that does sound totally legitimate. But, so they're like, oh, well, darn, we can't take you to town to use the phone to, like, call your husband so you can tell him that you got here safely. So there's that situation. But then later on, we see Roddy McDowell going back out and, like, fiddling around, like, underneath the hood of the car, and then getting back in the car works just fine. So obviously he did that shit on purpose. Now, he takes the videotape to this other house where this woman, who you can't really see, is, like, peeking out one of the upstairs windows, and he just, like, basically slips the videotape, like, into the mail slot. And then they show the woman from the back, like, you can't see her. She's watching the videotape later, and the first part of it is Mary Steenburgen doing the scene, supposedly as this Julie Rose actress woman. And interestingly, the scene that she talks about is very much like kind of the prologue that we saw at the beginning of the movie, with the woman getting killed in the car and her finger cut off and all that. Now, after you see her part, then, like, the doctor guy comes on and he says something like, well, here you go, here's the proof that she's still alive. Like I said, you know that there's some kind of weird, like, blackmail, kidnapping, something like that going on. And obviously this isn't a movie. Obviously Mary Steenburgen, or Katie, got hired, quote-unquote hired, or brought there, abducted, which she was didn't know it was abducted, got brought there because she looked like somebody that these two guys, whatever their scheme is, are trying to, like, make somebody else think that she's still alive, even though clearly she's probably not. Like I said, and that's not really a spoiler, because obviously you know that that's going on from that videotape. It makes it pretty obvious. So then, like I said, Katie doesn't really, she's a little bit suspicious, but not super suspicious. But then there's one scene where they're kind of, like, all hanging out in the parlor or whatever, like, having tea, and she's kind of standing by the fireplace. And she looks in the fireplace and she sees what appears to be, like, a part of her driver's license, which, alarming. So she kind of, like, pretends she didn't see anything, but then she races up to her room, like, the guest room, opens her wallet, and all of her shit is gone. Like, all of her, like, her driver's license, all her credit cards, everything. A little bit upsetting. Now, at this point, she kind of feels like, well, I don't know if she's, like, gonna confront, because she does actually confront the old guy, like, later on, but in a way, too, she kind of seems like, well, maybe it's better to, like, keep this shit on the DL, because you don't know, like, what they're capable of. And like I said, it's kind of snowing out. She does actually try to escape from the house, but It's freezing cold outside, obviously, and she only has like a little bit of a shawl or something on over her clothes, so she doesn't get very far. And obviously, like, Roddy McDowall like chases her and finds her and brings her back to the house. But just like in apparently the original movie, they're trying to convince her that she's just like imagining all this stuff. Oh, you didn't see your driver's license? That's silly. Why would we do that? And she's like, yeah, but all my shit has gone on in my wallet. Oh, you probably just forgot it all. You know how you ladies are. It's like, you know what I mean? Y'all don't know how to do anything. You don't know how sight works. You don't know, you know what I mean? So that's kind of like where the gaslighting thing comes in. And honestly, because the doctor, like the paraplegic guy, because he was a psychiatrist at some point, he's able to convince, like, if she starts flipping out, like, because at one point she does actually find like a working phone in the house and is able to call the cops. But one thing, she doesn't know exactly where she's at because, you know, they drove like a couple of hours into upstate New York. She wasn't super, she fell asleep on the road. She wasn't super paying attention. So she does not really, unwisely, is, I'm not victim blaming, I'm just saying, unwisely doesn't really know the name of the town or doesn't even know the address of the house or anything like that. You know, and this was back before they could really trace that kind of stuff, like unless you were on the phone for a really long time. So, because like nowadays it's like I'm an idiot, but back then you had to be on the phone for like X minutes or whatever before they could trace the location, or at least they could trace the location where the phone call was coming from. So yeah, so at this point what they do, it's like they basically drug her and lock her in her room. Now while she's drugged, she's freaking out at this point, and like the two guys are totally trying to like gaslight. It's like, we seriously, you're just imagining all this. We would never hurt you. We're not trying to do anything bad. You know, everything you've seen thus far has just been your imagination. You know, the only thing we didn't tell you, because they do actually tell him later on, oh, Julie Rose, you know, the actress she was supposed to be replacing, didn't actually just have a nervous breakdown. She also like committed suicide, and they had to tell her that because she was poking around in one of the rooms and found inexplicably some Polaroids of what appeared to be Julie Rose's corpse. So it looks like it's a corpse, but it looks like her. I don't know why you'd take pictures of that. Well, like I said, I guess it's like this elaborate blackmail scheme. So they were like, look, she's dead. But, you know, Polaroids, I don't know, that'd be really easy to fake. But like I said, there's a lot of plot holes in this. Just don't worry about it too much. So they lock her in a room, or no, they say, we're not going to hurt you. We're not going to bother you. You can lock the room if you want, if you're really that worried about it. So like I said, very gaslighty. So she not only like locks the door of her bedroom, she also like piles all the fucking furniture in front of it. What she doesn't know, though, is that there is actually, like, a secret entrance to her room, like, behind the full-length mirror. And apparently, like, while she's drugged, Roddy McDowall comes in there and cuts off her finger, which you'll note is the same finger that was cut off the woman at the beginning of the movie. So, basically, so like I said, she is able to call the cops. The cops come, but then, you know, the doctor is able to convince her. She's my patient. She's delusional. She does this kind of stuff all the time. So, like, everything she says, she's like, there's a body upstairs, because she finds, like, the other corpse, you know, of Julie Rose, like, in the attic or whatever. And she's, like, trying to tell them. It's like, they're trying to kill me. They cut my finger off. They did this, that, and the other thing. But, of course, you know, after the doctor and Roddy McDowall convince them that she's a crazy person, they're just kind of like, yeah, that's cool. Then they go up to the attic and they can't find the body, because they're not looking that hard, to be fair. Not super helpful, these cops. But yeah, so, but like I said, she does actually end up finding a phone at some point, and she not only calls cops, but she also calls her husband. And even though she's not entirely sure where she's at, and she sounds a little bit incoherent because she's freaking out and like they just cut her finger off, which, you know, that would be a little alarming for anybody. So she's not really able to come up with any really good details for them to be able to find her. Like, she's just like, the town is called Pine something. You know what I mean? She's like, I can't remember. And then all she can remember is like, gold. She says something about goldfish, because when they stopped at a gas station, like on the way up to the house for, they again, inexplicably, over $10 worth of gas, and they give you two free goldfish. They just give them to you in a bag, like in the middle of winter. I was just kind of like, I don't know why. But yeah, so it was goldfish. But so she did remember that. So her her husband and brother actually do kind of like figure out just by, and she remembers something about a covered bridge. And so just by triangulating how long she was probably on the road, where the covered bridges were and stuff like that, they are actually able to kind of try to track her down, but it's taking like a really long time for them to get up there. And meanwhile, the two guys, you know, the doctor and Roddy McDowall, have, you know, taken away all pretense that they actually have her best interests at heart, and are just straight up trying to like get rid of her now. So like I said, I don't know if I want to spoil the necessarily the resolution of the mystery, but like I said, the really my complaint about this is that the resolution is that the mystery is so complicated that I wasn't really sure. Like, I had to I watched the movie and I'm just kind of like, wait, what? And then you know what I mean? And then I was like, I think I kind of get it. But then, like, I read the Wikipedia page and I'm just like, I don't know. I get it, but I don't really know. I guess, like, the motivations weren't, like, crystal clear to me. It's, you know what I mean? It had to do with, you know, yes, she was basically hired to replace this woman that was dead but was supposed to be alive, which I got that. But the weird thing is that she's dead, but then her sister was the one that killed her, but then they wanted to convince her sister that she was still alive, even though, I don't know, it was like this whole thing. But, well, you know, I guess I get it. I don't know. Well, like I said, I don't want to get too much into it because it's a thriller and you kind of want to figure the mystery out as it goes. I'm not, like, confused about the sister murdering and stuff like that, but I am confused about why the doctor, the psychiatrist, who apparently the sister, whose name was Evelyn, and is also played by Mary Steenburgen. So Mary Steenburgen actually plays like three parts in this. Why the psychiatrist convinced Evelyn to blackmail her sister to begin with. Like, I think that was what was confusing me. I'm like, what would be the motivation of that? Like, she's your patient and the sisters hated each other. So he's like, oh, I have an idea. Why don't you just blackmail your sister? And she's like, oh, good idea. But then she ends up killing her instead. I don't know. It's like I said, it's super convoluted. And I don't really know how different it is from the original film. Like I said, this is a very, very loose remake because in the original movie, as far as I could determine, you know, the woman's one, it's in England. This is set in Canada, although it's supposed to be upstate New York, but they shot it in and around Toronto. The original one's in England. And it was a young woman who was not an actress, but she was just going for a job. Like, she was going to go be a live-in secretary for an old woman. And then they kind of, like, try to make her somebody else. You know what I mean? Like, they say that she has, like, a nervous breakdown and you're this other person. So I guess that's kind of what happens in this. But they're not trying to convince her that she's Julie Rose, necessarily. They're trying to pass her off as Julie Rose to someone else. And then later on, when she starts to twig on to the fact that something nefarious is going on, then they're trying to, like, convince other people that she's actually this person that's dead, just so they don't get in trouble. You know what I mean? So I guess it's, like, it's similar, but it's not exactly the same. Like I said, if you're into, like, 80s thrillers, particularly ones like Death Trap or something like that, and you haven't seen this one, because I feel like I didn't realize how fucking forgotten and obscure this was, because I don't know why. It's like, for some reason, something about this one, maybe it was like the wintertime setting, or like I said, the actors that were in it who I was liked, and I watched a lot of their movies in the 80s, but it's like, I remember seeing this so many times on cable back in the 80s, and it obviously, you know, struck a chord, or, you know, I remembered a lot about it, or I remembered, like, the title of it, and I remember liking it, because as soon as I saw it, like, come up on Amazon Prime a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that, like, with that creepy old house and, you know, and all that. So I was, like, excited because I was like, oh, I remember watching that a bunch of times on cable. And it's not like I'd forgotten, like I said, what the plot was, but I kind of remembered, like, how the house was cool and it was all wintry and everything. But that was kind of all I remembered. So it was really interesting to revisit it. I don't think I liked it as much this time, just because, like I said, some of the plot holes are kind of, like, glaring, but it's honestly, it's, you know, like I said, you could say that about a lot of thrillers. You know, they're not, I mean, the whole genre is supposed to be these ridiculously complex plots that would never work in real life. I mean, you know what I mean? That's kind of like what the whole genre of the movies are, of those movies are. So, I mean, if you can get past that, this is actually, like, a really lot of fun. I think Roddy McDowall is my favorite thing about it, because he's just playing such a good, he's one of, like, the friendly villain type of thing. The doctor guy is kind of like, he's kind of sinister too, but he doesn't come across as sinister as Roddy McDowall does, even though Roddy McDowall is kind of like this, he's like overly friendly type of thing, but it's like in a way that's sort of like creepy. So I think he's a lot more intimidating and scary than the guy in the wheelchair is, even though I think the guy in the wheelchair is supposed to be, because Roddy McDowall's character is basically just his manservant. I'm not really sure, like, he just kind of lives there and he just does all his stuff for him, like, he cooks for him and, like, takes care of the house and, you know, does all the casting. He did the casting call thing, so he's his driver, so he just, that's kind of like his his servant or his valet or whatever, I guess he is. But he comes across as more sinister, even though he's friendlier initially, if that makes any sense. So it's on Amazon Prime. Like I said, it was free for a little while, which is why I kind of got excited about rewatching it. But then when I went to watch it yesterday, they didn't have the free one available anymore, so you had to pay $3.99. But like I said, you know, if you like thrillers from the 80s and you haven't seen this one and you want to see one that's kind of like a little bit forgotten about, then it's totally worth the $4 if you want to check it out. If anybody else has seen this, because I feel like nobody's seen it but me, if any of y'all have seen this, tell me what you thought about it in the comments, and you know, we'll talk about it. We'll see what you thought of the mystery and everything like that. And that will do it for this Flickers of Fear. I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.